This is Digital Dave.
And I'm Fast Eddie.
And we do go, duh.
A lot.
Pennsylvania a lot.
Especially right before we go on the radio.
And then we go, yo, Adrian.
We have too much fun with this.
Anyway, sure. We're joined by Mr. Steve McCaughey of the Seaplane Pilots Association.
Or there
Seaplane
you go.
Something Association. Pilots should be in there somewhere.
It is. So
you believe that aviation is no fun unless you get wet.
That's right. You know, we say the fun way is no runway. So, you know, getting out there on the water is just an incredible experience. And, you know, it improves your stick and rudder skills. And we get to see things that most people never get to see, go places that most people never get to go.
They have to worry about fish strikes.
Oh, geez. Oh, my aching eyes. How do you explain to the insurance company you bumped a whale?
Yeah. Oh, you saw that video.
Anyway, so we have you're here to do seaplane things.
All kinds of seaplane things. We're running from here, the radio show, out to the seaplane base to work with the Women in SOAR Project. So we've got 86 young women out there that we're going to take for a tour of the lagoon, try to get some of them up in the air. We've got our corn roast Thursday night, sellout affair always, where we get 700 seaplane pilots together and have a little dinner and live music and some activities.
I guess you guys don't do hangar flying, though, because they don't usually sit in hangars.
Be lake flying.
No, we sit out on the beach.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that sounds terrible.
That's disturbing.
I have one question. A 172, a Cub on floats. How in the heck do you pre-flight it? You can't get out to the wing.
You walk on the float.
Yeah,
you can pull it around the dock or pull it around the beach usually.
Yeah.
So you get wet.
Yeah, exactly.
You get wet on your pre-flights.
Okay.
I could just see a wonderful way to pre-flight an airplane. Plop, glug into the water.
Yeah, going across the crosswire at the front of the floats on the bow of the float, you have to go from one float to the other, and it's literally a wire. And so many pilots go swimming that way. So.
Leave wow. your cell phone in the plane during the pre-flight. Yeah,
exactly. I cannot tell you how good we have been for the iPhone company, you know, for Apple. So a lot of iPhones go swimming with seaplane pilots. So
you don't like landing on land?
No. I mean, it's kind of uneventful.
Huh? Yeah, it doesn't do anything interesting.
My runway's always moving. It's shimmering. It has waves. It, you know, is doing things.
Water skiers.
I was going to say, did you see the sea breezy that was out here?
Yeah, pretty incredible, huh?
Somebody put a breezy on amphibious floats, and they've got the steering wheel off of a boat for the control wheel. It's hysterical.
It's incredible. You know, and that's what's really cool. I mean, we're seeing a lot of airplanes that we never thought would be equipped with floats being equipped. The LSA market, it seems like 70 to 80% of the new LSAs that are coming out are either a flying hull design or they're float equipable, which is just wonderful. It's wonderful to see, you know, this part of the industry. When we see GA kind of being stagnant by most people's, you know, interpretations, we see nothing but growth in the seaplane world. You know, we represent that sense of adventure, the extreme sports. You see that, you know, the same attraction of the Harley Davidsons and the RVs and the boating community. So, you know, we have a great attraction, which is we're very
well. Those airports aren't closing as fast as the land-based ones.
No, but
they haven't been able to build any housing on them yet.
There have been some issues with some states closing lakes to seaplanes, and I know you guys are probably right all over that.
Oh yeah, you know, advocacy is a major part of our role. You know, a lot of my time is spent keeping water open and working with communities to open water. You know, Colorado, there's never been legal seaplane flying in my lifetime. So we're working really hard right now to open in Colorado. Florida, where I live, is just amazing. You know, Wisconsin, Minnesota is usually, you know, pretty open.
Well, lots of water.
Yeah, lots of water, and the states are fairly seaplane friendly. But Ohio historically has not been very. We've got some new people in leadership in Ohio that's opening water, helping us open water. Maine, very open. So it really depends, and there's no national policy on it. So one of the things we're trying to do is develop a national policy, because the waterways, we have the Water Landing Directory app that we created and maintain. It's the only database like it in the world, but that's the only way you can really find out, is the water open or not open?
So well, what happens if you land on water that's not open?
It depends.
Yeah, it depends if you get caught or not. Quick, go!
Well, what about getting a seaplane rating? How difficult is it to get one?
You know, it's wonderful. It's fairly easy for the most part. Now, to become a competent seaplane pilot is a whole other story. But the great thing is, for about $1,600 to $2,000, most people can do a seaplane rating. We have 78 schools around the country that do the ratings. It counts as a BFR, and you can do it in 2 to 3 days usually. So it's a wonderful way to go accomplish your BFR. You know, for me, I'm a ratings collector. I'm always looking for the next rating, the next type rating, something to do. And but for me, it increases your stick and rudder skills. We give you increased training. You're going to have a heck of a lot of fun, probably the most fun you'll ever have doing a license. There's no written test either. So there's an oral exam and a practical test, but there's no written test.
Now, 99% of those ratings are done on float planes or flying hull designs?
Right now, probably more float than flying hull. Flying hull is more popular in the LSA world, but we have the Lake aircraft, we have the Seabees, so there still are a lot of legacy. All the Grumman legacy aircraft are flying hull, and of course, I'm Grumman Albatross type rated, so do a lot of the heavy metal. I fly everything from the, you know, Sea Rays up to the Albatrosses.
Up to the Gooey Duck.
I love the Gooey Duck.
So
I want to
I.
see those guys run. That's a beautiful. It was outside the radio station a couple years ago.
Yep, sure was. And that was a very interesting aircraft. We have to get them back.
They need to put two of the Rotec radials on it.
There you go. Yeah. That would work out well.
Oh, that's a great concept. You know, it's a composite airplane, so it really is, and it's in between, sized in between the Goose and the Widgeon, so the size is really good. Mm-hmm. It's composite, so you don't have saltwater corrosion issues, so I think it's really positioned well. I'd like to see them take that to a certified airplane.
Yeah.
That would be neat. How did you get a rating in an Albatross? That's a big airplane.
Open your wallet.
You found somebody and said, hey, I've got an Albatross school. Bring money.
A very understanding wife.
Yes, exactly.
That's she owned the Albatross, too.
So we got married in an Albatross in flight. We had six Albatrosses in the water at our wedding, and we did the ceremony over the Grand Canyon. And once you start getting around these aircraft, you kind of get obsessed with them. I'm sure like the B-25 guys that were just in here. You know, same thing. You get around the aircraft, it's just kind of addictive. And so I was like, okay, well, we've been married in one. I have to have my license to fly one now. And you just can't.
And that sounded like a logical argument to her?
Yeah, it did, actually. She gave in. And you know, you can't. Dollar-wise, you just can't justify it.
Right,
you just
right.
can't. It was funny. This was in, you know, 2003. I think it cost $300. I figured out it cost $350 in fuel to start the engines and get to the numbers, just to get to the numbers.
Right.
And then once you put the power on, 400 gallons an hour on takeoff and climb. So you can't even think about it.
Nope, never mind.
But, you know, you can always justify it saying it's something I've always wanted to do. It was on my bucket list, and it just seemed like the right thing to do at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah, it sounded like a good idea at the time.
And there's less than 200 pilots in the world that have the type rating, so it kind of puts you in an interesting club.
Well, does anybody call you and say, can you fly my Albatross?
They do, actually. I've flown about 50% of the world's fleet, and most of the owners want three type-rated pilots to fly the Albatross at any one time. So the opportunities are there once we have the rating, but keeping
right.
current's an issue also.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you met Jimmy Buffett? Because he's got an Albatross.
I am chasing Jimmy Buffett down. Jimmy, are you out there? We need you. So actually, his is parked. The one we got married in, he operated for 3 years. And he bought his Albatross from the gentleman that owned the one that we got married in. So
nice.
He's a very avid seaplane pilot. He has a caravan on floats. He, you know, we hear stories from our friends that work with him, you know, in Maine and Louisiana, all over Florida. So he's out there flying, you know, literally several days a week. He
has that kind
active.
Of a job that allows that freedom.
Yeah, well, you know,
yeah.
by design.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good to be Jimmy Buffett.
It is good to be Jimmy Buffett.
But so that's the attraction. Throw away everything, buy a seaplane, go fly tourists on some tropical island.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've got a little airline that started up in South Florida 2.5 years ago with a single 206. And this is what we see in the seaplane community, which is really bucking the trends of general aviation. 2.5 years ago, started with a 206 that I wanted to buy. They bought it. And now here they are with four caravans, two malls, and a 206 operating to the Bahamas from South Florida.
Wow.
I'd say they're doing all right.
They have the mall on floats, too?
Two malls on floats.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know they made them.
Oh, yeah. It's a great performing seaplane. The mall's wonderful.
Did you ever see the picture of the DC-3 on floats?
Yeah. I've actually kind of grew up with that airplane. It was in Florida at one point. Now it's up in Greenville, Maine.
It still exists?
It still exists. Yeah, there were a couple of them. It's not on floats currently, but it's for sale, and the floats... It could be put back on the floats, but that was done for the
I got 20 bucks.
Yeah, I don't think that'll do it.
I'll throw 50. I know, that's the biggest airplane that's ever been on floats.
On floats, probably, yeah.
And I just thought, you know, that's the goofiest looking thing.
Well, aren't two of the Martin Mars still being used as firebombers?
Still have the Martin Mars out there, which were the largest, seaplanes ever, other than the Spruce Goose, of course, which I've had the very good opportunity of spending some time in the cockpit and walking down the insides of the wings and everything else. But, the Mars are still operational. I don't know. They're up for sale right now, so I know what's going to happen with that. But what a great airplane.
Honey,
I need a type rating. There's even fewer Mars pilots than there are Albatross pilots.
There you go.
there were only, what, four of the Mars flying boats that built?
Four or six.
No, actually, it was really interesting. We just did a couple years ago, I did a documentary for the Navy for the 75th anniversary of the China Clipper flight. Which we were very, very fortunate. The Navy opened up all their archives, and we went to Alameda, where the flight originated from, and we had a lot of their surviving crews and stewardesses and things like that. But I actually have seen photos of squadrons of Mars that were at Alameda.
Wow.
So they actually had a large fleet, but the operational, by the mid to late 1960s, they were winding them down. And we ended up with the ones that are up at Sprout Lake. But what was really interesting about the Sprout Lake ones, I mean, they came with like 80 extra engines and tons of spare parts. So the ones that are up there doing the firebombing, they have, you know, an endless supply of spare parts because there was a large fleet originally.
Well, there's a four-engine bomber or four-engine float plane out there. And I don't remember which one it was, but it was like one of the largest ones ever built. There was four of them, and I think there's only like two of them left now. They were using them as water bombers up in Canada, I think it was. I forget.
That's the Mars.
Mars.
Yeah, that's
okay.
The Mars.
Four-engine.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if they had built only four of them. Maybe I've got it confused because I think they may have had only like four of them.
Do you remember that Dornier that was here that had the three? That was a goofy-looking thing.
I flew it.
Oh, of course. Like I had to ask.
So I had just come back from a film project in Australia, and my wife's like, oh, we got to go hook up with Irene Doinier. He's in California. You need to fly that airplane.
Wow.
She's a keeper. She is a keeper. So we actually got to spend a week with Irene, and I'm very proud of the fact we put cameras all over the airplane, and I did 11 passes post 9/11. With permission, 11 passes through the Golden Gate below the tops of the arches.
Wow.
Nice.
So talk about an unbelievably, you know, just amazing experience.
I want your job.
I was going to say, is this video on YouTube?
No, it's not. Believe it or not, we've got a huge mass of footage that we're trying to chunk through right now. We're working on some television projects, things like that. So we're trying to chunk through some of that footage and get back. And Irene's a great guy, and that airplane's amazing. But I have to say, the Albatross handled better in the salt water and the ocean environment, because the Doinier was built in the early 1930s, originally had three radial engines on it, but it's a flat-bottom airplane.
Right.
So it was like landing a John boat in the Pacific.
Yeah, exactly.
It was very, very rough, where the Albatross has a V-hull and it would cut through. So the Albatross actually did better in the saltwater environment. So it's kind of interesting to pick up those nuances on the airplanes.
Right. Right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Steve.
Well, thank you.
And we shall all make a trek down to the seaplane base.
Yeah, come down to the seaplane base. Come over to 3167 or 68 in the Hangar C. We've got a wonderful booth. We've got a dock set up with rippling water in front of it projected on the floor. We've got some great new T-shirts. We've got a scholarship program to make young seaplane pilots for free. It's a zero-cost seaplane rating when we award the scholarship. So we have all kinds of programs coming on. We love talking seaplanes. It'll change your life. We hope you get involved.
All right, sounds good.
Sounds all right to me. Hey, I'm Fast Eddie.
I'm Digital Dave, and this is EAA Radio.